Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
We're 1 year since Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. UN says that more than 8,000 civilians have died, hundreds of children, and, you know, though the true death toll really, I mean, I don't think it's too hard to realize this, is probably much, much higher. The military casualties on both sides are estimated to have climbed into the hundreds of thousands. It's mind-boggling, really. But you know what? Amid all the horror, there are still signs of hope. And we have a very special guest with us here today, Jeff Semple. He is a senior correspondent with Global National News in Toronto, and he was able to take some time out of his day. Jeff, thanks so much for spending some time with us here today on The Roy Green Show.
Hey, David, great to be with you.
Am I understanding this correctly? You recently returned from Ukraine?
Yeah, I got back from our most recent trip a couple of weeks ago. And then prior to that had been, that was the third trip. So we were there in the sort of the first days of the invasion in March of last year, then returned last summer for another 4 or 5 weeks, and then just recently returned from a third trip. And, you know, quite a difference, obviously, past year.
I can imagine, and Jeff, I would love to hear about that difference and how things have changed. But you know, I'm hearing on the radio, I'm hearing from others, I've seen it in print. It's the 1 year anniversary. I mean, I don't know. There's something about that just doesn't sit well with me, right? We're not celebrating anything here. This is really about commemorating something, and hopefully there's a celebration coming down the road.
Yeah, well, that's it, right? I mean, obviously the word anniversary sort of has different connotations and sort of wedding anniversary and that sort of thing. But we're, in this case, not celebrating anything, except perhaps for the fact that very few people a year ago thought that we would even make it to a year, right? I mean, it's easy to remember. I mean, I remember, you know, just over a year ago interviewing a laundry list of so-called experts, all of whom predicted that, well, most were predicting that Russia wouldn't invade, and those who thought it would didn't think Ukraine would last more than a few days. And here we are a year later. So I guess if nothing else, that's a positive. But you're right. I mean, it's a tragic day on the calendar. The fact that this has happened, the fact that it's dragged on this long. And one thing I, you know, hear a lot from Ukrainians is they don't like the anniversary talk because they think it distracts from the fact that their country has actually been at war since 2014, when Russia went in and took Crimea and started fighting in the Donbass. And so really, it's been, you know, many years of war in Ukraine, but obviously nothing on the scale of the full scale invasion we saw this time last year.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of Zelensky's 50, I think it was about a 15 minute speech. And he talks about this as being one of the most painful days in Ukrainian history.
Yeah. And, you know, I like, he's always a quote machine, that guy, as we say in the business. He's a very good talker. And he has a line about how they woke up early and haven't slept since. And I just thought that was such a good line. I mean, we've heard so many versions of that from like ordinary Ukrainians who, you know, especially now after a year, are just like utterly emotionally exhausted and traumatized. I mean, obviously, particularly people in frontline communities, but even in cities that are further away from the front lines, like the capital of Kyiv, you know, where people are to an extent trying to live their lives. I mean, they're going to work, they're eating at restaurants, but like almost every day still there are air raid sirens warning of incoming Russian missile strikes, and every day there are funerals. And so I think people are really sort of traumatized by that. But I would say, David, despite, you know, that trauma and that emotional exhaustion, the resolve of the Ukrainian people, from my experience talking to them, has only increased, it would seem. I mean, like, you can't find anyone who wants to throw in the towel. I mean, if anything, they're more defiant than they were before. Like, they're not willing to give an inch to Russia, even if it would mean ending the war.
They really are digging in a sense, on kind of all levels.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and I think for many of them, when I ask, you know, where is that coming from, right? You think after a year of this war, like, you would be looking for any kind of off-ramp. But it's, you know, a lot of them talked about just that they've paid such a heavy price that they don't want that to be in vain. I mean, I interviewed a 24-year-old widow named Lysia in Lviv, who just buried her husband. They got married a year ago, and just after the war started, the invasion happened.
So many stories like that, right?
Yeah, and then now she says even more. He was just recently killed in the last few weeks, and she said it has only strengthened her resolve, right?
Wow.
That we can't let them win.
So kind of a crazy question in a way, but the contrast. So you were there in the early days of this invasion. What are some of the bigger changes that you've noticed in that in 12, well, exactly to the day, 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one I think we alluded to already that at the beginning, I mean, it was like the whole country felt like it was under attack, right? Like no matter where you were, if the Russians weren't at your doorstep yet, they were coming, right? And now, clearly, Vladimir Putin's invasion has not gone according to his plan. And this is now, I think Russia has about 17-18% of Ukraine's territory now. So that's dropped significantly from, the early days of the war. And most of that territory that Russia has controlled and is fighting for is in the south and the east of the country, where you really see, some of the worst fighting and like just communities and neighborhoods completely flattened. But then, you drive, the distance from, the Donbass to Kyiv, I think, is sort of like roughly Vancouver, Calgary. I might be butchering that. Okay. I did look that up once upon a time. But it's, it's far enough away that right. It's, now it feels worlds apart, right? Like sure. Kyiv, yeah. You can go have a craft beer in the evening or a latte in the morning. You're still under threat, but so they've bizarre. Kind of gotten used to it. Yeah.
Yeah, this is becoming a way of life. I was out last week with a friend for dinner. Ukrainian waitress, been here about 7 or 8 months and it was very moving. She started talking about her brother who was still there and her family that were still there. Dad stayed and so mom did too. She came over on her own and it was so, the drive home for me was so, I don't know, help me out, Jeff. It was surreal. Really? This is the world we're living in? Like that was kind of, right? Is that naivete or is that something else?
That really reminds me too of like a lot of the scenes. One of the most heart-wrenching common scenes we saw like in the first days of the war were families being split up like that. Like there were the train stations and it was just heart-wrenching. Oh. Like you would see, fathers and sons putting their mothers, wives, daughters onto trains and then like, and not sure if that was the last time they were going to see each other. And that played out hundreds of times on every train platform in the country. Like it was just horrific. And now, yeah, a lot of those families are still apart. I mean, obviously some never came home. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around that. I mean, just the scale of not only the lives lost, but the families ripped apart or separated.
Oh, the damage, the long-term effects of the trauma and the PTSD and so on are just, I mean, how can we know at this point? I want to ask you about a show that you've produced that's going to be airing in the next day or two. I'd love to chat about that. But do you have a sense, Jeff, from the people you're interacting with and interviewing and so on, what's sort of next and a couple more years? I mean, it sounds like they're in it for the long haul.
Yeah. I mean, I was worried you were going to ask me that because I've just been so consistently wrong. Right. For the past year. I mean, it's just, yeah, like the, I think,
well, how can anyone know, right?
Yes, thank you for saying that. Yeah. I think I'll tell you, I'm not just saying this. I mean, it's become almost a cliche to talk about this sort of world famous Ukrainian resilience. We hear Vladimir Zelensky talking about how they're not going to give up an inch of territory. Like they're not willing to negotiate away a single piece of Ukraine. And that's the refrain we hear over and over and over again from the Ukrainian civilians. So to your question, like, where does this go from here? I just, like, I don't see, it's hard to see a negotiated settlement, period. Like the Ukrainians will not give an inch. And obviously, Vladimir Putin needs at least something resembling a face-saving off-ramp for his own self-interest. That's... So how do you reconcile those two things? I have no idea. But I will tell you, it's the American, especially the Americans and their attention span would make me nervous because not to take us in a totally different direction, but...
I think you raise a super relevant point about just attention span in general. What's going to happen as it isn't as interesting as it used to be, or it isn't as newsworthy as it used to be. What then?
Ukrainians are very, very aware of that. And they were very happy to do interviews with us because they know that keeping this in the international attention, especially for, like big funders like the Americans is vital. To their survival. Well,
global resolve, it seems to me, is essential. Hey, can you, as we wrap up here, Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about, is it called The New Reality?
Yeah, so Global's current affairs program is called The New Reality. It airs every Saturday at 7 o'clock, and we've got a special program this time around. We take you to a city I don't think anyone's seen or heard about before. It's this little city called Marhanets in south central Ukraine. It's right on the Dnipro River, and it has the unfortunate distinction of being located right across the river from a Russian occupied nuclear plant, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. Now, the Russians took control of this nuclear plant a year ago, and they've held it ever since. And they have rebuffed calls from world leaders in the UN to create sort of a demilitarized zone around it to ensure it doesn't get hit and potentially spark a meltdown. Instead, the Russians have used the nuclear plant essentially as an army base to launch attacks at nearby communities like Marhanets, which we visited. And they are defenseless. I mean, they wouldn't dare fire back, right, or risk triggering a nuclear disaster. So this community has been taking a beating. It's basically in a fight with its hands behind, tied behind its back. And so we went there in part for that, but also because there's a special relationship developing with this community of Marhanets and another community in Canada, in BC.
And super, so we will delve into that. And super important.
Yeah, I hope so. And so that, yeah, we'll delve into more of that story on the new reality.
Lewis Cohen. He's a filmmaker, producer. We're going to call him an Emmy award-winning showrunner. But check this out, quote, "It's tempting to believe that our present age of fake news and alternative facts is unique and unprecedented, but it's not. Since the dawn of civilization, people in power have played with the truth, danced with the deception, and altered reality to suit their interests, often with the help of propaganda and disinformation," close quote. That is from the press kit for a new series, TVO series, actually, 6 episodes, I believe, that our next guest, Lewis Cohen, is here to talk about. And I think we're even going to be taking some callers. Lewis, thank you so much for spending some time with me today on the show.
You're very welcome. Great to be here, David. Thanks.
Lewis, really appreciate it. There's so many places we can go. And first, I just want to say congratulations can I call it an epic 6-part series? I mean, really, this is super important. And I learned a ton. So first off, congratulations and thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, you can call it epic. I won't, but it was, one thing I will say about it is it was an incredible group effort. You know, it's a co-production and we have, directors, other producers, and you know, I was spearheading it, but unbelievable team of people doing the research and the interviews.
Yeah, and so just for our listeners too, I just want to say that we've got one episode, Weapons of War. We've got the Politics of Religion. There's a whole episode on conspiracy theories and scandals and the power of money and influencers. I mean, you really do go deep in a really compelling way. Can you talk to me a little bit about this idea that, you know, propaganda, deceit, deception has been around with us for a very long time?
Sure. I mean, you know, it is one of the discoveries for me of the show. It's not something that, you know, we tend to feel like what we're living is unique. I mean, both as individuals and as a society. So it's natural, you know, the internet never existed,
right.
Chatbots never existed, and so on and so forth. But yeah, when we look back, each episode really traces that exact idea. It starts out and says, where are we now? You know, so in conspiracy, we started out with COVID and all the things that has wrought in the way of conspiracy theories. In the war episode, we started out with, you know, ISIS and some of their antics in Syria. We're always sort of capturing the present moment, in religion as well, 9/11, as well as some of the revelations about the residential schools. And then we go back in time. This is the format of the show to the ancient world. So, you know, depending on which episode, it's a couple thousand years ago. And we see that, you know, whether it's Ramses II, the Pharaoh of Egypt, inscribing fake news about his single-handed war victory over the Hittites that never happened all over these temple walls. And people believe this, you know, for literally millennia until some archaeological discoveries were made in Turkey in the 20th century, or whether it's, you know, a monk in medieval England spreading lies about the Jewish community in the town and suggesting that these people, you know, had to ritually murder a Christian child every year, in some kind of conspiratorial cult. he was doing that. Ramses was doing it in Egypt to attract, to consolidate his political power, because he wasn't from a legitimate ruling seed in terms of his lineage. The monk, you know, was perhaps, we don't know for sure, but doing it to attract to get the victim of this terrible murder turned into a saint, and therefore attracting pilgrims to his new cathedral. So it was really at some level of popularity and financial contest.
Right.
These things have been going on, you know, around the world for centuries. It's not confined to Europe. It's not confined, to the Northern Hemisphere. It's not confined to the Southern Hemisphere. It seems to be part of human nature.
And so we have examples.
Lewis, what's really interesting to me is, if some listeners may know this, and I've been on air for a few years doing podcasting and hosting events, and I'm also a magician. So I'm kind of practiced in the art of deception. You know, I get paid to fool people. I get paid to deceive people and have a good time doing it. I mean, what I think you really have uncovered here is that this is wide and it's deep and it goes way back. I mean, on one level, you go, wow, I had no idea. But on the other level, for me, this is deeply unsettling how deep it really does go.
Yeah, it really is. It's unsettling. And one of the things that I think maybe David, go ahead.
No, that's great. Yeah, go. You were just going to say what might maybe compounding it?
Yeah, what may be compounding it, you know, and makes it even more unsettling right now is just the sort of power of the technology.
Right.
You know, that's amplifying, spreading, communicating these lies and sort of, you know, I mean, we've talked about the sort of siloing of information and the way in which, you know, there's been a kind of fracturing of social cohesion, partly by this technology. Everybody's able to find, I mean, I'm obviously talking about the internet, you know, their little feedback loop where they're getting their worldview reinforced, and the technology is so powerful that some of these messages are getting, you know, either carried into the mainstream or spread globally in a way that wasn't necessarily possible before. And we've seen this at different times in history. We saw this with the development of the printing press, which comes up in the series a lot. It just amplified what was going on and made certain lies possible, possibility of spreading them faster, farther, and more convincingly than ever before. So that is definitely one of the disturbing things. But of course, you have to ask yourself, if this is our nature, that some of us, in any case, if not all of us, are willing to take advantage of others and to sort of, to spread disinformation and lies about our opponents, whether they're already ideological opponents or our competitors.
Sure.
In the world of finance, well, whatever it is. This is obviously disturbing self-knowledge for humans to have and how to.
Well, and all of a sudden, Lewis, all of a sudden too, it takes on a whole new meaning. It's this is about fear. It's about power and distrust. And can I even say lack of relationship?
100%.
Lewis, what are your thoughts on what's currently happening from a propagandistic? Is that the right word? Perspective, you know, in relation to Ukraine and the war and what we're actually seeing. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's definitely, I mean, it's technically not part of the series. I'm happy to offer an opinion. I do have to emphasize, you know, that this is outside my realm of expertise.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
well, Lewis, how about we circle it around to how can you ever really know?
I will say one thing though, David, is that what's incredible is sometimes when you read about the lies of history, you know, as I have researched, you know, there's six stories in each one of our six episodes. So there's 36 mini documentaries here. So I've looked at a lot of lies and some that didn't make the cut. You know, you sort of say, well, how could people believe this stuff? It's so outrageous, you know, or it's so self-serving, whatever, these different reasons that you might feel like just stupefied. And yet it's interesting to circle back to Ukraine is the things that Putin is saying to Russians and, you know, and to the world, to anybody who wants to listen, are, you know, in his own country, for reasons that make total sense, widely believed, you know, at least according to the polls that seem to have some reliability. And it's incredible. You see in live action in the 21st century how some really just stupendous lies and manipulations and self-serving proclamations can appear to be the truth under certain circumstances. So I just, that is the one thing that I take away that relates directly to the series.
Sure, sure. How can you ever really know in the moment? Like, doesn't history sort of tell us and teach us that you look back and you understand? You know, you see the dots connecting, right? When you get to watch the TVO series called Truth and Lies.
Yeah, for sure. If you get to do, you know, a year of research and interview some of the biggest experts on the different stories, and the stories themselves have a lot of literature. Yeah, for sure. But it's incredible. You know, something I was listening to. So I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know how.
I think
the least ideological possible is one of the ways in which we get to the truth faster. My little attempt to answer that question. So I lean left. I try and hover to the center. But there is, you know, an incredible podcast I was listening to this morning in which two completely mainstream Harvard, MIT scientists have talked about the high probability in their view that the COVID-19, you know, was escaped from a lab. But that is such a controversial and toxic perspective because it's associated with conspiracy theories that ironically we can't even hear about it. So CNN and BBC won't play this story.
Right. You know, so it's almost like it's already confined within some kind of bubble.
Exactly. You know, and so the point is, it's not a right-wing problem. It's not a left-wing problem. As soon as we get ideological, we stop seeing, you know, some of the more nuanced realities in front of us.
Hey, can you just really quickly tell us, was I right on that? It's TVO. Can you tell us how your listeners can see this series?
Yeah. I mean, I should have researched this during the ad, but you know what I always do when I want to send the link to, you know, we aired weekly for 6 weeks. That ended last week. We are on TVO.org, TVO.org, Truth and Lies.
Truth and Lies.
Google TVO.org or TVO Truth and Lies. It'll bring you to a page. It's really user-friendly. You've got, you know, it's the Truth and Lies page. You've got 6 episodes lined up with, you know, each one.
And no subscription required, right, Lewis?
100%. No subscription required.
There you go.
Anybody in Canada.
Yeah.
It's not available otherwise.
We're talking about something that I think we're going to reflect back on and see as a bit of a thread for today's show. Anxiety, fear, mistrust, you know, what do all these things sort of mean for us, you know, globally, I suppose, of course, but more importantly, what does it mean for us individually? How does it affect us and our neighbors and, you know, how we live our lives and how we teach our children and how we run our businesses? And so we have Eden Rahim here with us. He's a portfolio manager for Next Edge Capital. You can find out more about them at nextedgecapital.com. And he works in biotech, life sciences, and believe it or not, philosophy. I had to get that in there, Eden. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
David, delighted to be a guest again.
So Eden, you know, there's this study, so I've just become familiar with it in the last couple of days. And on one hand, it's kind of alarming. And on another hand, you sort of think it makes a whole lot of sense. So the headline is Trust in Government is Recovering, but a New Generational Trust Gap is Emerging. And what this study is finding is that even though the aggregate trust among Canadians is up 5%, apparently it was 34% in 2022, apparently, and by the way, that's the highest it's been since 2019. What they're finding is that a younger demographic is that they're not a big surprise here. Their expectations are different, and this could lead to, you know, different voting priorities and different approaches. But what's interesting is that it's connected, it seems, largely to economics, to where we're currently at, and this could really upset the electoral map, it seems to me. Can you talk a little bit about some of that uncertainty economically and what you're seeing at the level that you're working at?
Yeah, sure, David. And thank you very much for pointing out that article to me. I found it really intriguing, you know, the bifurcation that we saw between the oldest group, you know, such as the boomers, and the youngest group, such as the Gen Zers, and, you know, the extent to which their trust in institutions and their outlook differed. I think with the older population, they pretty much had the system and the institutions work in their favor over their long lives, and, you know, are more politically invested in parties that preserve that, no matter what affiliation that may be. versus the experience of the Gen Zers, which, you know, in their young lives, you know, they've seen the system raised to the ground, first through the global financial crisis 14 years ago. Then, you know, most recently had their high school and university social years stolen from them in a way due to the lockdown. So, you know, I think they're more guarded and more skeptical about decisions made by our generation. You know, they've learned that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, I think.
Well, and I Eden, that's really interesting and insightful. And it's, even though it's a cliche, it just, it so sheds light on our current state of affairs. I mean, when we look at what's happening, you know, globally, geopolitically, good intentions are not going to get us there. It seems to me. Check this quote out, Eden, from Bruce McClellan, who's the president and CEO of Bruce Strategies. Quote, while trust is improving as we surface from the darkest hours of the pandemic, we see an emerging tsunami of change with younger generations losing trust and changing expectations, close quote. I mean, that's a doozy, as my father would say. What does that mean to you as an investment portfolio manager and as someone who's hoping that some of these younger people are going to be, you know, you not only using your service, but, you know, continuing to invest in emerging markets?
So, you know, I'm pessimistic over the near term, but I'm optimistic long term as the world shifts and, you know, they become the leaders of tomorrow. So about 25 years ago, I read this really fantastic book called The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe. And it brilliantly telegraphed sort of the attributes of what the Gen Zers were in all the different generations, from the boomers to Gen Xers to the millennials to the Gen Zers. And you know, it basically correctly identified this generation. You know, they're more akin to the war generation of the 1930s and the 1940s. You know, I actually consulted my own homegrown Gen Zer, Saskia.
Right.
Description of
go to somebody you can trust, Eden.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an expert opinion.
That's exactly right. By the way, Saskia is Eden's daughter. Eden, hey, just before you step into that, what was the name of that book again for our listeners?
It's called The Fourth Turning by
The Fourth
Strauss
Turning.
And how. And, you know, I remember back in 2000, I bought like 7-8 copies. I didn't yet know you, David. If I had, I would have gotten you a copy as well. But I bought 7 or 8 copies for friends. And it was
wow,
the best
that's
book
a commitment.
Written. Yeah, and what is this? It basically breaks down demographics into sort of 20-year generations. And, okay, you know, it's just brilliantly, you know, it's some of the, you know, the forecasts that were made then have just played out brilliantly. And it's not looking into the future and knowing. It's just how different, you know, groups by generation, you know, changes their behavior and what their ideals are and so on. So the reason why I say that, you know, why there's reason to be pessimistic in the years ahead. Long term, we're in good hands because the Gen Zers, those that are, you know, sort of late teens to their early mid 20s now, you know, they have certain ideals. You know, like my daughter told me, you know, they're entrepreneurial, they're resourceful, they're creative, they're trailblazing. But, you know, they feel a greater need to take their lives into their own hands rather than trust fate or trust the system. And, you know, ultimately the millennials, you know, they're still rising in influence, but ultimately this generation will take over and, you know, they'll probably create, you know, a better world on a stronger footing with greater influence than, you know, than we have.
Yeah. Well, Eden, I think that's a pretty profound thing to say about the younger generation that, and I think I'm old enough to say this now, that we often sort of poo-poo, right? We get nostalgic about, oh, wow, things used to be so much better in the past. And I'm not so sure that's true. I there's a huge part of me that does trust future generations. And I mean, check this out. So in this, again, if you want to find this study, it's the 2023 Proof Strategies Can Trust Index. I had never heard of it before, but it shows economic anxiety is impacting trust. Look it up, and it was just published just about a week ago. But check this out. So a slim majority of Canadians are at about 50%, 3% who expect that, you know, business leaders like yourself should be speaking out on things like climate change and racism and equity and so on, right?
Yes.
53. Younger Canadians, though, have higher expectations. 61% of Gen Zers compared to 48% of boomers. I mean, aren't companies, Eden, that you're investing in, aren't they going to have to start taking notice of that?
Yeah, and it happens every generation. So if you go back to the past generation, you know, we've if every generation that comes along, you know, they're irrevocably changing the world better by you know, forcing change and thrusting change upon things where we're accountable more for our actions. And I'm speaking as, you know, a company would look at it and so on. And so I'm a staunch believer that, you know, progress just, it happens in maybe five steps forward, three steps back, but it's always right. Upward, always onward. And every generation changes the world for the better. These ideals come into place. And, you know, and do you remember when the Thames was a dead river back in 1970? Mm. And, you know, certain groups got active, you know, we no longer kill whales to extinction. And, you know, we have green blocks. Green boxes and blue boxes, right? And, you know, change is slow,
right.
But it inches forward. And
yeah.
Every generation has an ideal that they put forward that helps us to react to it. I think, you know, in that study that you sent me, David, you know, one of the really intriguing things coming from the philosophical side that, you know, obviously you and I have had a couple of decades of conversation over is, you know, the relative trust in others. You know, and
yes.
And you know how high it is for boomers versus Gen Zers, you know, and trust in others. And I think that's almost a, and again, I'm giving away my age here, but I think it's how relationships are experienced in a pre-technology world, such as boomers and Gen Xers have experienced, you know, where your word is your bond, and, you know,
yeah.
Technology didn't define the relationship. And yet you see how trusting they are about relationships versus, you know, the technology-fueled world
right.
Where relationship interactions is very different.
Sure.
You know, perhaps much more mile-wide, inch deep.
I think perhaps more
performance-oriented, you know, and yet their trust in others is so much lower.
Everyone's time is important, and that is exactly what I believe our next interview really is all about. We have with us the chief executive officer from Four Day Week Global. Any eyebrows raising out there? I hope so. The headline I'm going to read here is a 4-day work week can be life changing. Should Canadians get one? Dr. Dale Wheelahan is here with us. He is a behavioral scientist. And he has completed his PhD in exploring, wait for it here, folks, the impact of fatigue and sleep deprivation in healthcare workers, particularly surgeons. And of course, he's published extensively in his field. Dale, thank you so much for joining us on the show here today.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So Dale, I was wondering if you could just sort of step into what your research has been telling you. I know that what I've been looking at here is a 6-month trial that was done, 61 companies, 2,900 workers. And I think the thing for me that really bubbles to the surface is this is about, I don't know, is it about working smarter, not harder, but it's about changing the way people work. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Absolutely, David. I think the analogy actually I saw today that really fits the whole approach of the 4-day week is it's about, you know, taking the canary out of the coal mine, providing it resilience training, and then trying to send it back into the coal mine. You know, it's a futile effort. So we really need to look at changing the coal mine, or in this case, the workplace and how we do work. And so that's what has been the work of 4-day week global for the past few years. I think it might be useful just to give a bit of context. 4-day Week Global, we're a not-for-profit company which was founded in 2018 on the success of two founders, Andrew Barnes and Chad Lockhart, who piloted a reduced working hour in their own company, Perpetual Guardian, in New Zealand. And from that, found huge success, of which they have run pilot studies across the US, Ireland, the UK, and now we're currently running pilots in the European Union, South Africa, Brazil, and we plan to expand as well then into Australasia in the coming year as well.
How much of this has been sort of fueled or driven by the sort of, we're not quite post-pandemic, but I suppose we are to some degree, or have we been talking about a four-day work week for some time?
I think we've been certainly having an immature conversation around the need to reduce our working hours for many years, and certainly that's what academics have been talking around. You know, it's been well established within the research that cognitive fatigue is reached at a much quicker rate when compared to physical fatigue. And when we look at our traditional working models, which we have as, you know, 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 in many instances, it's modeled off as an industrial revolution style of working where people were a lot more physical. Research has consistently shown that about 3.5 hours of productivity is all we really get in any given day when we're using our brain in a strong way. And so, yeah, basically, I think we have this ground of evidence, but we haven't, I suppose, the means to drive the conversation forward. The pandemic obviously rose the conversation around mental health and well-being in a way that society has never discussed. And we saw radical changes within the workplace, such as hybrid working and flexible working. So I see reduced working hours, the completion of a trifecta of intervention to improve the lives of workers, and ultimately what we have found in our research improves the businesses or the organization's performance as well.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, I was going to make a kind of a light comment there while you were chatting, but I didn't want to interrupt your flow. The 20-minute reminder to get up out of your chair on your Fitbit or whatever your device is a very good thing, from going from being so hyper-physical, you know, 100 years ago to basically being relatively sedentary, you know, in these days.
Absolutely. And I certainly, something I try to practice what I preach, my own PhD, having been in the space of fatigue. And, you know, when we look at the signs around what causes fatigue, a lot of it is around when we start to feel that little niggle or kind of a strain when we're doing our work, that's the best time to get up and to move. Mm. And actually, when we begin to experiencing that strain even throughout the day, we typically do experience it around the lunchtime mark or, you know, coming into the evening time. So what we're trying to achieve is that with a radical change in how we work to allow us to not let that strain be pushed into a disengagement and a burnout.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up burnout. The study that's out of the University of Cambridge in the UK, and I believe Boston College in the US, and I believe a think tank in London as well, 61 companies, 2,900 workers participated in this. So the study finds that 39% of employees were less stressed after the four-day working week, and 71% had reduced levels of burnout at the end of the trial. I mean, what are we waiting for?
Yeah, and so that's the study, the study that we partner with those universities and with those companies in the UK. And these are our findings. You know, we worked with companies to help them introduce reduced working hours, and our partners in Cambridge and Boston have found these fantastic results. I think what it means is that it's the most radical transformation we're seeing in tackling growing levels of burnout and stress that we're seeing in society. I certainly have experienced it both in my background as a researcher, but also in my background as a healthcare worker prior to this, that, you know, tokenistic approaches to well-being are extremely laborsome and also futile. And what I like to call is window shopping wellness.
You know, right.
Mandatory mental health talk or yoga at lunchtime is not going to reduce burnout when the workforce itself is under a huge amount of pressure and doesn't have enough time to actually, you know, detach from their work and stop.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Hi. Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.